many thanks to the organizers, of course. It's a great pleasure to be back here. I have two quick announcements before we get into the math. The first is I want to call your attention to a web page. Whoops. Right, that's it. So I recently learned that I'm one of the organizers for next year's East Coast Operator Algebra Seminar.
Sorry, Nate.
If you buy me a beer, I'll forgive you. So anyway, this is the web page for the conference. It's going to be next fall. The dates are October 11th and 12th. So as a member of the organizing committee, I threw out a suggestion. I thought perhaps we should just get rid of the conference and make it a big party. And Nigel and John weren't so happy about that, but I'm still working on them. It's possible. So if you're not busy next fall and you'd like to come to a big party, I mean conference, just please do join us in State College. That was a joke. Just kidding. So the other announcement. Yes, some of you know I've been working on a book for a number of years, and it's finally finished. And this is a great, great day for me. I can finally tell you that our book with Ozawa is finished, and so I thought that I should dedicate this talk to my good friend, co-author, and general menace to society, Taka Ozawa. So, here's to you, my friend. Okay. So, yeah, I'm going to talk about embeddings into R omega, right? So let me remind you of some definitions. So R is always going to be the hyperfinite to one factor. Yes, and we're going to fix a free ultra filter. Whoops. We're going to fix a free ultra filter, and let me remind you what R omega is. So R omega is just the bounded sequences in R modulo the sequences that tend to zero in two norm. So that's what R omega is, and this will be fixed data. I also have a standing assumption throughout the talk here. So N is always going to be an R omega embeddable finitely generated 2-1 factor. As Ken pointed out, right, Kahn's embedding problem is not known. And this talk is not about that problem. So we're always going to assume that the factor you start with is embeddable. And the finite generation actually is not important. Separability is fine, but it'll be a little easier to understand some of the things if we just assume finite generation. So I will. Okay, so let me give you some motivation. Well, that's kind of annoying, isn't it? Is that annoying you too, or is it just me? You too? Okay. I'm going to do this. Oh, that's a good idea. Isn't it? Okay. How's that? Hopefully that's better. So what's the motivation? So there was a theorem Kenley Jung proved a couple years ago. That said, it said the following. So suppose N is as above, right? Then what he showed was that N is isomorphic to R to the hyperfinite 2-1 factor if and only if there exists a unique embedding and unique, of course, up to unitary conjugacy, because you can always conjugate by a unitary and get another one. So this is up to unitary conjugacy. And this theorem, so he actually showed more. It's even equivalent to knowing that there's finitely many. Okay, so if you have a 2-1 factor and if you know it admits only finitely many embeddings into R omega, then it has to be the hyperfinite 2-1 factor. Okay? And really what I wanted to do was just understand this theorem, right? I mean, it's one thing to go through the proof, right? You can go through the proof and you check it and everything works fine, but somehow I wanted to understand it. So let me point out two sort of concrete questions that arise. The first one, right, so let's assume n is not the hyperfinite 2-1 factor, right? What does this result say? It says that if you're not the hyperfinite 2-1 factor, then you must have infinitely many embeddings, right? And the fact is, if you think about, let's think about this example. That's an embeddable factor, but I really don't know how to produce very many embeddings. I know how to get one just from residual finiteness of the group. That's not hard to do. But I don't know how to produce others, right? So the first question is, once you have one, and once you know that it's not hyperfinite, how do you get another one, right? Where's the second embedding coming from? And this, by the way, I still don't have an answer to. I mean, a conceptual answer. If somebody could give a nice conceptual explanation for where the second embedding comes from, that I would like to know. However, there's a second question that's posed here, right? Because this says not only is there two, it says there's actually infinitely many. So the second question I wanted to understand was, given two, two different ones, right, non-unitarily conjugate ones, can you construct others, right? Infinitely many, preferably. Okay. So that was a bit of motivation. The other result, which was also motivation here, was due to Kenley and Dima. And what they showed was that if n has property p, I'll write it like this, the space of asymptotic embeddings is discrete, so what I'm really referring to here are the microstate spaces, and Dima has just informed me about 15 minutes ago that due to my lack of knowledge, this maybe shouldn't have been proper motivation, because what I wanted to do was understand at the level of R omega itself whether there's a real discreteness property. Right, whether property P implies that something is discrete. And the mistake I was making was to actually consider R omega as opposed to the analog of R omega where you use matrices. Okay? So if you use matrices, this is the proper space for this result. Okay? But in any case, let me just proceed. So I still did want to understand what is the space of embeddings. Is it really discrete? Is it anything like that that you can say in the property T case? And it turns out that the answers are quite easy. I should say all of this is very preliminary work. At this point, I have far more questions than answers, but I suppose that's the story of my life. So, anyway, let me just keep going. So let me give you a definition here. So let's consider the Hom space, which is all maps into R omega modulo unitary equivalence. Okay? And from a representation theory point of view, right, if you want to study embeddings into R omega, nothing could be more natural than to consider the set of embeddings and mod out by a natural equivalence relation, so that's what we will do. And the first result here is that this space is always a path connected complete metric space. All right? And in particular, well, let me describe the proof and then you'll see precisely how to answer question two. It turns out to be very, very simple. I'm embarrassed to tell you how long it took me to figure out how simple it was, but anyway, at the end of the day, it turns out to be very simple. But what you do see immediately is this is a path-connected space, so there's no discreteness, not for this space, right? There very well may be another space where discreteness is reflected in a proper topological space, but I suppose the right one to check first would be to look at the Hom space where you replace R with just matrices, right? I don't know what happens there. I don't know if it's discrete or not. But anyway, let me just outline the proof for you here. So first of all, let me describe the metric. It's the most natural thing. So suppose you have a couple of representations, right? And that denotes the equivalence class, of course, of the representations. We'll define their distance to be the ints over the unitary group of R omega of the distance between, minus add u, the distance between a generating set. So here, I'm assuming that X is a generating set. Of course, I've written it as if it's a single generator. It doesn't really make any difference if you have a single generator or an n-tuple. If you have an n-tuple, you can just take the max over the n-tuple in the generating set. So I'll use this notation just because it's a bit simpler. But anyway, that's the metric. And then you have to do, there's a little exercise. It's actually cute. It's not very hard, but it's kind of fun. You have to show that this thing is really a metric as opposed to a pseudometric. But anyway, as I say, that's not hard to do. It's just a fun little exercise. Completeness is very simple, too. Completeness just boils down to the fact that the unit ball of R omega is complete in the two norm. Okay? Once you know that, and you also need to know that moments determine the von Neumann algebra, but once you know these things, then completeness is easy. The path connectedness is also not hard. So I want to define a path, right? Given pi and rho, I want to define a path between them, and all you do is this. You take projections which commute with the image of pi, and the image of rho, and this should be a one-parameter family. And it's not hard to check that this always exists. You can always show that you can always show that the commutant of a separable von Neumann algebra is going to be diffuse just by thinking about central sequences. So once you have a diffuse commutant, you can always find a one-parameter family projection. It goes from 0 up to 1. And then you just consider the representation that takes an element x, so this is an n, right? It goes to pt pi plus pt perp rho, and this defines for you a homotopy from pi to rho. Okay? So there's nothing deep or tricky going on. But anyway, that's the proof of this theorem. Right? And notice by the way, it shows that the second question actually is not the hard part of Kenley's theorem. Right? The hard part of Kenley's theorem is understanding why you have two. Once you get two, you can get infinitely many. That's no problem. Because notice this is a continuous map. Yes, from the unit interval into the Hom space. Okay? So you have a path. And of course it's gotta be uncountable, in fact. So the corollary of this, oops, done. The corollary of this is following our equivalent, so M is isomorphic to R. The cardinality of this Hom space is less than the continuum. Oops, R omega. This has an isolated point. And the last one, the last one is that for every pi, the commutant is a factor. And I'm not sure if I'll have time, I'm not sure if I'll have time to explain why this is of such interest, but this one I think is perhaps the most interesting here. I actually would like to say it, because I think it's kind of nifty. You see, this isn't any old homotopy, right? It's not like I've shown that there is some homotopy. It's quite explicit. It's just a line, right? And so you sort of imagine that this Hom space has an affine structure. I mean, I have to be honest and say I don't know if this map that goes from the unit interval into the Hom space, I don't know if this map is injective. I'm not sure. I mean, it might be injective, it might not. I really don't know what to expect here. But nonetheless, you can sort of think of this as being a sort of line, right? And I believe that representations where the commutant is a factor should be the analogs of extreme points, right? So you have a space here, and it has a kind of affine structure, and so you might imagine there's such a thing as an extreme point. And the factors, the embeddings where the commutant is a factor will play that role. So what I mean is, if you have an embedding where the commutant is a factor, then it's not possible to stick it in the middle of a line. Okay? If a line hits one where the commutant's a factor, then both the endpoints had to be the factor to begin with. I mean, I'm sorry, the embedding whose commutant is a factor. So anyway, that I think is something I intend to look at much more. Anyway, it's true. Oops, oh no, my finger's caught. Ah! Let's see. Yeah, actually, I do have time. Let me just say, this fourth one, the case where the commutant's a factor, it doesn't follow from the proof over there. You need another proposition. And so the proposition that you need to get the fourth one is this. If you fix pi, so given an embedding and projections that commute. Projections that commute and have the same trace. Alright, so you fix an embedding, you pick a couple of projections out of the commutant that have the same trace, and the proposition states that if I take pi and I cut it down by p, just like over there, right? Now, you have to be a little bit careful here, because when you take that representation and cut it by p, you now live in a corner of r omega, right? But every corner of r omega is isomorphic in a almost canonical sort of way, not quite, but there's natural isomorphisms between corners of r omega and r omega themselves. So if you take pi and you cut it, now you live in a corner, and then you take one of these isomorphisms back into r omega itself. That's what I mean by this notation. Anyway, the result is that the cut down by these two projections of the same trace will give you the same class. They'll be unitarily equivalent if and only if P and Q are Murray von Neumann equivalent in the commutant. All right? And that this is the proposition that you need to get the fourth statement there. And corollary of this, well, I mean, I guess I've already stated it here. So what follows from this is that if you have a non-hyperfinite embeddable factor, then you can find an embedding where the commutant is not a factor, right? And another question which is on my mind and I'd like to know the answer to is whether or not, I mean, how bad can the commutant be? Can it have a huge center? This I don't know, right? At this point, all I can say is that the commutant has at least one projection in the center. And I'd like to know if you could construct representations whose commutants have a very large center. And, well, let me try to explain why that might be relevant. You see, because what you have, yeah, so you now have a topological space associated to a 2-1 factor, right? And so you could ask whether or not topological invariants give non-trivial invariants of 2-1 factors, right? Every time you take a topological invariant, you get an invariant of these 2-1 factors. And it's natural to ask whether any of these topological invariants are non-trivial. Honestly, I kind of doubt that they are, but still, it would be nice to know that as opposed to just believe it. And so let me describe some results in this direction. Oh, that's still bad, isn't it? Right. Let me give some questions first, and then I'll come to these. So one of the basic things I do not know about this Hom space is whether or not it's compact. I kind of doubt that it is. I kind of suspect that it's always non-compact. I mean, except in the hyperfinite case, right? Of course, in the hyperfinite case, it's just a point. But in the non-hyperfinite case, I don't know if it can be compact ever, or whether it's always non-compact, and I would like to know the answer to that. The same is true, I don't know about second countability. Again, there, my first guess is that it probably isn't, but I really don't know. And that would be nice to know. And then, yeah. Okay. Well, would it suffice if I show you how to get it from this proposition? Okay. So what you do is you consider. So here's what I'm going to prove. I'm going to prove that if you have a non-hyperfinite, then there is a representation whose commutant is not a factor. That's what I'll prove. Okay. Right, so how do you do that? Well, if you have something that's non-hyperfinite, then it has two different representations. And then you put pi here and rho here with weight 1/2 and 1/2. And the point is that when you cut this one, what you get is pi. when you cut that one, what you get is rho, and they can't be the same. So it's the proof that this implies four is just a little trickery. Right. So the second question I want to ask is something about the dimension. Right, so here what I mean is the topological covering dimension, all right? Because this is, I should say the metric structure, of course, the metric structure on this space certainly depends on the generators. Yes, the topology does not. You can easily show that the topology you get by changing the generators is the same. So you need to be looking at topological invariants. And so we can ask what happens with things like dimension. And again, my guess is that this is probably always infinite, but I don't know that, right? And even in the property T case, it would be quite interesting to know for sure what the topological covering dimension of this is. But let me tell you what one can show. You can show that the dimension of a tensor product is greater than or equal to 2. And the proof of this is that there exists, so you have to prove this, you have to show there exists a continuous embedding from the Cartesian product of the respective Hom spaces into the Hom space of the tensor product. And this is the key word here, right? It's got to be continuous. And once you know this, then you're done, because this is a path-connected space, so it has a one-dimensional subset, right? This is path-connected. It has a one-dimensional subset. And so there you go. Right. So that's what you can say for tensor products. By the way, although now that this has been cleared up, this difference between R omega and matrices, it's far, far less surprising than it was before for me. But what this shows is that there's not going to be any connection between delta naught and these dimensions, right? Because these will always have free entry dimension 1. Yeah? Whereas as this dimension is growing for tensor products. Okay. And in my remaining minute, I will also state that if you look at a free group factor, you can show that this dimension. Yes, I do. Thank you. You can show that the dimension of the Hom space is greater than or equal to n minus 1. Again, my guess is it's probably infinite, but I don't have a proof of that, and I would like to have a proof of it. And the reason actually is quite similar to the tensor product case, because what you can show is that if you take a free product, there is a map that goes from the Hom space of n cross Hom space of M, you can show there's a map into the Hom space of the free product. The problem is it's not continuous, or at least I see no way to make it continuous. All right? So this argument breaks down. However, you can make it continuous on the product of the one-dimensional set here and the one-dimensional set here because it's so explicit. Right? This one-dimensional set is not some crazy thing. You write down exactly what it is. And because you can write down exactly what it is, you can find a continuous map. Well, you can find a map from the product of the Hom spaces into the Hom space of the free product, which is continuous on the product of these two one-dimensional things. So this dimension will be, that shows that for a free product of two things, you have dimension 2, and then a result like this. Yes?
doesn't tell you?
Well, so that's a good question, right? Because, so if you have an inclusion, so this goes back. Really? Well, I don't know. But it is the extension problem. That's the problem, right? When you have an inclusion like this, the Hom spaces, you have maps the other way. Right, so which way? I guess it goes this way. Yes, every homomorphism of M restricts to a homomorphism of N, so you have a map this way, and I have no clue if this is injective or surjective or anything like this. But you may be right. There may be some natural conditions which will guarantee that this is either injective or surjective, but I haven't got to those yet. Thank you. Yeah, so that's actually the only case where I can prove it's infinite dimensional, is L of F infinity. Yeah, but somehow you would like it to be, yeah.
So very naively, if you take two points at different points in this half space, you have this joint commutant of phi of n and rho of n, any projection into this huge commutant is non-separable.
Yeah.
Give you another point. Naive, of course,
does not prove. Well, the thing is, you don't know if it's a different point. This is the whole issue. When you cut, what you can show for sure is that there are tons of projections in the commutant such that when you cut, you don't get something different. Okay, this is not hard to show, but. The question is whether there are projections which do give you something different. And in cases, there are. But in general, I don't know what to do. Yeah?
I have people who are in my first report. I somehow went for a different tangent. So when I asked you, I thought that, you know, what you meant to say was that any two-one factor has an embedded factorial. And that is actually a very nice problem, and I thought about that, and, you know, that's interesting.
It is, no, it is, and indeed, I meant to mention that question. I don't know that. Indeed, let me, for the sake of everybody, let me repeat the question, because it is a good question. Take a non-hyperfinite 2-1 factor. The question is, can you produce an embedding whose commutant is a factor? Right. This is also something I would like to know. Which.
And my second question is that if there is a problem that I popularized a lot some years ago, it goes back to a question of Masamichi, and which is the following. Not very hard. The hyperfinite one factor, any embedding. So the relative, you have a bicommutant here, and the question is whether that is the only one factor in this type of problem. So of course, along the line of also the coin, but it's a bit stronger. So you have R into, you know, any embedding. Well, in R omega, of course, it's a coin. So we have R into R omega, and it satisfies R prime, that is the R omega prime,
Right.
There are these versions of that you can do this question.
Yeah.
Like N question is the following two. N is a two-one factor, is a property that N is into